Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Mary Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad,
good morning.
Are you getting excited about recording the 100th episode of this podcast, which we are not doing today, but we will be doing in just like 5 weeks down in San Diego?
The countdown has begun. It's getting very close. Yeah, I'm excited. I can't wait. This is going to be a first time for me. I mean, first time recording a podcast in California. First time recording a podcast live with an audience and folks there who usually just listen to us, but they can actually see us this time. And it's going to be, well, I guess we have done this one more time with Eric, right?
Yeah.
Eric joined us one other time. So this will this will be the second time where we've kind of brought together the Old and New Testament guys into one podcast. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, people get to hear all the stuff I edit out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we'll have to be careful. No editing is going to take place.
People don't realize these podcasts are actually
live.
Yeah, these podcasts are actually an hour and a half long when we record them, and then I just have to edit out about, 50 minutes of stuff.
Right. The process of purification, right?
That's right. I got to have
purifying going. This is undiluted. That's what's going to take place in San Diego.
Yeah, you guys hear like the edited, sanctified version of 40 Minutes. You'll get to hear the raw, uncut version. They're probably going to check your IDs at the door, make sure you're old enough.
Yeah, probably so. 21 and older, that's all.
Yeah, but you guys should come out and see that happen. But that's not the best thing going on. That's just a pre-conference perk. What you really want to come for is all the other speakers and all the food and all the hanging out and all the celebrating. You know, Chad, I saw an article, and this is completely off topic, not off topic of the conference, but off topic of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, but I'm going to say something about it anyway. It was in Christianity Today, which is obviously about as mainstream of a Christian publication as there is. And I don't know if you saw this, but it was talking about Luther and the Protestant Reformation. It was crazy. They did a Pew Research poll of Christians in America and found that 52% of Protestants do not believe that faith alone is enough to get a person into heaven, that good works are also required.
So you tell me that 52% of Protestants aren't Protestants.
Right. It was kind of interesting. It's something I've been saying that for a while, that it seemed like sola fide and sola gratia were definitely waning within the church in America. I didn't think the number was that high. I didn't think it was over half that would come right out. I sort of thought like functionally it was missing. But, if asked straight up, is faith alone enough? I figure most Protestants say yes, but functionally what they present is something else. That's sort of how I looked at it. I was a little shocked that when just asked, right, just point blank, can you get to heaven by just believing in God or do you have to do good works? That over half said, no, you have to, good works are required as well. That was shocking. And just lets me know that we kind of 500 years after the Reformation, we are apparently in need of another one to recapture some of these truths, which is what I hope in the midst of celebrating the Reformation and kind of everything that we do, this podcast and Christ Old Fast in general, is to try to be one of the things that contribute to that, that kickstart that. And I hope that this event just gets a fire going and people leave there ready to go and promote those reformational truths, because obviously with those numbers being what they are, it's direly needed.
Yeah, I mean that's what we're all about, is getting the message out there to help those 52% as well as everybody else realize what the Reformation was all about. I mean, it's all about the gospel. It's all about grace alone. It's all about Christ alone. It's all about faith alone. But I mean, that runs so contrary to a lot of what people have taught in churches. And certainly it runs contrary to every experience we have in the world, that you can't say it just once. You can't just have it as sort of, an important part of what your church is all about, but not kind of essential. No, it has to be the driving force behind everything that the church teaches, everything the church sings, everything that this podcast is about, everything that Christ Old Fast is about. So, yeah, there's the ongoing need for reformation is always going to be there, this side of glory.
Yeah. So if you guys want to be a part of that, I recommend you come out to San Diego. You still got time. You can still get in on that. You can go over to herewestillstand.org and come and hang out with us. It'll be a big, huge party to celebrate what was done and hopefully an instigation of things to come. And we'd love for you to come be a part of it. Herewestillstand.org. When you register, if you want to get 10% off of that ticket price, you can type in the code at checkout, 40OT, and that'll get you 10% off. Come hang out with me and Chad and a whole bunch of other people. All right, enough about that. We're 6 minutes in, and we haven't said anything about the Old Testament. Chad, where are we at in Exodus?
We are about halfway through chapter 27, and we're going to finish up that chapter very quickly because there's just not a whole lot I have to say about it. And then we're going to jump into 28, where we will spend the rest of today and possibly part of the next podcast as well. So the first part of 27 takes us into a description of the altar. If you've been listening along, you know that we're right in the middle of a long section in Exodus, which is God describing to Moses how Moses is to instruct the Israelites about how to make and put together the tabernacle, the tent itself, as well as the furnishings, as well as everything else connected with it. So we've covered the tent itself. We've covered some of the material on the inside. And now we moved outside to the altar, the outer altar, or the altar of burnt offerings, or the bronze altar. It goes by all of those names. That's the first part of 27. And then the last part, most of the last part, verses 9 through 19, describe for us what's called the court of the tabernacle. Now, you may have heard about the various courts in the plural of the temple. Of course, the temple is the permanent structure that's built in Jerusalem. The tabernacle is the movable structure, the tent. So that's later on. Later on at the temple, you had the priestly court. You had the court of the men. You had the court of the women. You had the court of the Gentiles. So you had these concentric circles going out for various kinds of people, as well as whether they were men or women. But at the tabernacle, you basically have just one court. That is, it's an area that is around the tabernacle. It's in rectangular shape. And this is basically the area immediately around the tabernacle where the priests do all of their work. There's not a whole lot there. Really, all that you have there are two main articles of sacred furnishings. You have the altar, and then you have what's called the laver. It's a big washing basin for the priests to wash their hands and their feet in. We haven't got to that yet, but that's really the only two things that you have out there. And this is surrounded then by a curtain that's high enough that you can't see over it. So the whole area of the tabernacle court is screened off, and it's inside this that the priests are engaged in sacrificing and getting ready to do what they have to do with the blood and the bodies of the sacrifices, as well as going into the tabernacle itself. And so this is the description basically of the materials that are used, how it's all to be put together, so on and so forth. So it's completely enclosed. Now on the east side, there is an opening. It's screened off, but that's where the priest would go in and out. So just like there was, you kind of have, if you can picture this, you kind of have three different gates or veils, if you will. We talked about the inner veil. That's the one between the most holy place and the holy place. Then you have another veil, which is the veil in which you enter the tabernacle itself, in which you enter the tent into the holy place. But then you also have a third veil or entrance, and this is the one into the court around the tabernacle. So three different entrances there. And depending on who you are and what your responsibilities are, You might could go through one, you might could go through two. And if you're the high priest, once a year, you go through all three of these. So that's it. That's the court of the tabernacle. And then the chapter finishes off with just a couple of verses about the kind of oil that is to be used to light the lamp inside the holy place, the menorah. It's supposed to be made from olive oil. There were different kinds of substances that were used to make oil in the ancient world, but olive oil produced the cleanest and the purest oil, and that's what was to be used in lighting the menorah, which was to be kept burning within the tabernacle itself. As was part of the priestly duty as they ministered in the tabernacle, was to keep that light going. So anyway, that's not a whole lot of theology there, but that's the way that the chapter wraps up, and that kind of gives you a picture of the entirety of the tabernacle. So you have the screen around the court, you have the court itself, and then you have the tabernacle proper, the holy tent within that. So we kind of have now, at this point in Exodus, we got the whole picture in our heads. And now we're going to switch gears. Chapter 28 chapter 28 and 29 actually are going to take a little bit different focus for us. We're going to begin to talk now more about not the structure itself, but rather we're going to talk about the people who are involved in carrying out the various duties around the tabernacle, and that is the priest. So chapter 28 is going to describe the clothing that they wore, and then chapter 29 is going to get into the ordination of the priest. So what we're going to spend the rest of the time talking about today is more or less what you find inside the closet of a regular priest and inside the closet of the high priest. Now, you might be thinking that you're going to sleep through the rest of this podcast, because what possible interest could there be in what Old Testament priests wore? Well, I think that you'll find this quite interesting. At least I'm going to endeavor to make it as interesting as I can. Because really, what this is all about is not what kind of clothing the priest wore. Rather, this is about how the particular clothing or vestments, if you want to call them, this clothing, in one way or another, was a picture of the person and the work of Christ. Because as God told them, article by article, what they were to wear, what jewels were to be on there, how many jewels, what the words on some of this clothing was to be, all of this was pointing forward to who the Messiah, the great great high priest, was to be, and what his purpose was in coming to be that priest and to offer himself as a sacrifice for us. So that's really where we're going with all this, is how the clothing that the priesthood would wear was an icon of the priest who was to come, that is Christ himself. So that's what we're going to be diving into with chapter 28. So as we do, or I guess as a preface to what we're about to talk about with the vestments of the priest, I think it's good to just pause for just a moment and to remind ourselves really what the purpose of the priesthood was. Because this is something that's really new for us. I mean, up to this point, the only priest that we've encountered in all of Genesis and, there's two priests we've encountered, all of Genesis and then up to this point, Exodus, we've got two. We've got Melchizedek that we met way back in Genesis 14. And then we met the father of Moses, Jethro, earlier in the book of Exodus. So we got these two priests, but we really haven't had any occasion to talk about an Israelite priest. And that's because up to this point, the people who were engaged in what we would now call priestly actions really weren't those who held any kind of office of priesthood. It was more or less either the patriarch of the family, or it was the firstborn sons. They were the ones who were building altars and offering sacrifices and things of that nature. It wasn't a set apart group of people whose duty it was to serve the Lord in the priestly office. But that's about to change because Aaron, who is the brother of Moses, and then his sons after him, throughout the successive generations, they are going to be the ones who are set apart to serve as the priest of the priest of the Lord. Part of what they did, most of what they did, was involved at the tabernacle and then later the temple. I mean, they would offer sacrifices. They would pray. They would lead the people in the singing of hymns. They would teach the people. All of this took place at the tabernacle and temple. And then after they served there, they would go to their homes, and they lived everywhere throughout the Holy Land. Unlike the rest of the tribes, the tribe of Levi, where the priestly family came from, they didn't have a specific part of the Holy Land that was theirs. Instead, they had cities that were scattered all throughout the Holy Land, and this is where they had their homes. So it's almost like God purposely spread out the priests throughout the whole promised land so that they would have a chance to be really the teachers of Israel. They could be the ones who lived, you know, with the tribe of Gad or with the tribe of Benjamin or with the tribe of Judah, whatever tribes they were living among. They could be the ones who took the word of God and taught it back home. And then when it was their duty, they would serve at the tabernacle for about 2 weeks, and then they'd go back home. So this was God's way of spreading out the priest most of the year so that they could teach the word of God wherever they lived. But most of their duties took place at the tabernacle and later at the temple. So let's get into chapter 28. And then as we go along, we'll talk about more of their duties, but this is the way the chapter starts out. God tells Moses to bring near Aaron and his sons with him. So you have Aaron, you have Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. So you have Aaron and his four sons. It goes on to verse 2. It says, "You shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty." So that's one of the purposes of these holy garments, or these vestments that the priesthood, for glory and therefore beauty. So just to pause there for a second, I think this is significant. This is not always something that we take time to concentrate on. In the tabernacle itself, and even in the clothing that the priests were wearing, one of the purposes was to demonstrate, seeing that there's gold all inside the tabernacle, that the veil between the holy place and the most holy place is embroidered with cherubim. So one of the purposes was simply to be beautiful. So God is concerned with beauty. He's concerned with the beauty of the world. He's concerned with the beauty of his worship, because this beauty is a reflection of who he is. Everything that is involved with his tabernacle and with his priest to reflect the beauty that is himself, as well as the glory that is himself, as it were, a mirror reflecting the beauty of the one who is being worshiped. That's one of the purposes that this serves. Now, glory is connected with God himself, whose glory inhabits the tabernacle. So these vestments, as well as the tabernacle itself, also are a reflection of the glory of the one whose glory sits inside the Holy of Holies. So that's one of the purposes of these vestments. The rest of the purpose we'll get to as we talk about them item by item.
You know, one thing I think is interesting is how you might think about your church and how maybe you probably don't have like cherubim woven into stuff in your church, or maybe you don't have gold stuff. Most churches probably can't afford to have gold plated everything, but we do. Not every church does this, but I think they should, because this is completely affordable and doable. When you talk about this displaying the glory of God, You are talking about a tabernacle that is pre-cross, and when we talk about the glory of God, and they, so if they're thinking about the glory of God, the best picture they sort of have of it is sort of the heavenly realm. They have like cherubim and these kind of things. Like the glory of God is sort of up in the heavens, right? Now the glory of God has made itself low in the person and work of Christ. And when, as Christians, when we think about the glory of God, we don't have to think about angels up in heaven or the throne of God or something like this. No, we think about the cross, where the glory of God is actually best displayed. This is God's glory coming and manifesting itself among us, is this gruesome scene on Calvary. And most churches now have crosses on them or in them. So I think it's always weird when I go to a church and there's like no cross anywhere. It's super odd. And one of the reasons is obviously very practical that you have it there is to remind you. So you have this thing that's there to remind you what this is all about. But also, if you are trying to have something going on that represents the glory of God as Christians post-cross, there's nothing that does it better than the cross, which is counterintuitive because you would think that maybe a bunch of gold-plated stuff or angels woven into fabric would display the glory of God better, but actually nothing displays the glory of God better than a cross.
Yeah, you know, there's even hints of this, at least if you look at this part of Exodus from the perspective of its fulfillment. There's hints of this as well in the Old Testament. In the vestments that the priests wore. I was thinking about this, I guess it was last week when I was looking at this section. When priests put these vestments on, one of the things that's going to happen, we're going to see this in the next chapter, one of the things that's going to happen is they're anointed with oil, but they're also sprinkled with blood. So it's pretty amazing, at least to me it is, this trouble to have these beautiful, glorious, perfect vestments that's made, and then you sprinkle them with blood.
Yeah.
So there's this pretty in Exodus, there's this hint that the glory of God and the beauty of God is always a bloody glory and a bloody beauty. There's always the blood of sacrifice that touches the glory. Of course, this is most visibly seen in what you were just talking about. It is finally in the cross of Christ that we see the glory of God made manifest. So anytime we have a church, you know, across one of our churches or a crucifix or however you want to present the death of Christ visually, that is the glory of God. That is the manifestation of the glory of God in his suffering.
Yeah. It's almost as if you do all these things. It's very ornate and detailed. And at the end of it, God says, you know, none of this is actually acceptable to me apart from blood.
Yeah.
You can make it as beautiful and you can plate it with as much gold as you want, but apart from blood, none of this is good enough.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you see that with the mercy seat or the seat of atonement. I'm sure it was just, you know, astonishingly beautiful. I mean, this is a gold plate. And then what does God say? I need you to put blood on that once a year. The veil between the holy place, the most holy place, embroidered with cherubim, you know, the finest material they had. And yet it gets sprinkled with blood. The vestments get sprinkled with blood. There's blood all over the altar. Now, this isn't meant to be gross. It's meant to underline the fact, as Leviticus is going to tell us, that the life is in the blood, and God has given it to the Israelites on the altar to make atonement for their sins. And so the life of God for us is always in the blood of Christ, nowhere else. So for us, everything that is sanctified, everything that is glorious, everything that is beautiful, made beautiful by God, always has the blood of Christ on it, because that's the only means whereby we receive life and are made holy, is by that blood.
Amen.
All right, so let's get into what some of these garments are that the rest of the chapter talks about. So you kind of got two different categories here. Most of the chapter is concerned with what the high priest is going to wear. And just imagine what this would be like. So if you're the high priest, you have to have help getting dressed because there is so much to put on. You've got basically eight different articles of clothing that you're going to put on if you're the high priest. If you're a regular priest, then you got four, three of which are the same, one which is a little bit different. So if you're the high priest, the first thing that you're going to put on are, and this is kind of funny, but it's your linen shorts. That's the last part of this chapter. We'll go ahead. We'll start from the inside out here. So you're kind of your linen underwear, if you will.
Is this like the magic underwear of the Mormons?
I think this is different. Yeah, I believe this is different. You know, it is kind of, it strikes us as funny, but this we've actually already seen a little bit of this in an earlier description of the altar. God doesn't want them to expose their nakedness around the altar. I was doing some research about this morning, and there's ample evidence that at least in some parts of the ancient Near East, it was not uncommon for those who were engaged in worship or even leading worship around an altar to do so in the nude. That's the way some pagan peoples did it. And God says, well, that's not the way we're going to do it at my tabernacle. In fact, I want to make sure that, you know, if you're wearing a loose robe, something isn't revealed that shouldn't be revealed. So I want you to put on these linen breeches, these linen underwear. I mean, this is, and this was unusual too, because we don't have any evidence, zero evidence that I've been able to find. In the ancient Near East, or even anywhere else in the Bible, of anyone else who wore clothing like this. I mean, that the oldest kind of underwear, if you will, that people wore were loincloths. In fact, in the tomb of King Tut, they found several linen loincloths that I guess were popular with the Egyptian royalty back then. But there's no evidence of any kind of linen shorts that were designed to go from the waist down to the thigh to make sure everything got covered up. But if you were a priest, whether you were an ordinary priest or a high priest, you had to put them on. So you slip on your sacred briefs in the morning if you're going to be serving. You got that. And then kind of working your way out to everything else that you're going to have on. You have a tunic that goes next to your skin, which would reach all the way down to ankle length. You've got a robe that goes over the top of that. So you got your linen shorts on, you got your tunic on, and then you put a robe over that. And then you've got this what's called an ephod. You can kind of think of it as a big vest that goes on. And there's no sleeves on it, just a vest. And then on the front of it has what's called a breast piece, which we'll talk about in just a minute. There's a little pouch inside of it. And then, so that basically has your body covered. And then you've got kind of a turban, some kind of headpiece that you put on. And then you have a sash, kind of a belt around your waist. And then the last piece of the vestments was you get a headband. And on this headband is written Holy to Yahweh. So you got your hat on, you got your headband on, you've got your inner and outer garment on, you got your linen underwear on, and then you have this big vest on that has the ephod on the front. So all of this is pretty heavy. In fact, there's gold in it. There's no telling how much weight this actually added to your body. But this is what the high priest would wear when he was ministering. Now, you may have noticed, if you were paying close attention, that there's one part of your body that's not covered that we usually do have covered when we're dressed up, and that is there's no shoes. And that's because the priests, when they were ministering around the tabernacle and then later the temple, never wore shoes. They were always barefoot. In fact, I've read in some Jewish sources that there was actually a doctor employed at the temple in Jerusalem, one of whose duties was to care for the feet of the priest, because it didn't matter if it wasn't just summertime. This was all year round, even the wintertime, the priest did not minister with shoes on. And the reason goes all the way back to Exodus chapter 3, when Moses is before God in the burning bush. What does God tell him? The first thing he says to do is take off your shoes, because the place where you're standing is holy ground. Shoes in that culture be very, very unclean. It sort of makes sense. You go everywhere with your shoes on. You walk into bathrooms, you walk through mud. It's all sorts of nasty stuff that your shoes come into contact with. So the bottom of your shoes is considered to be unclean. So you take them off when you are ministering around the altar and within the tabernacle and later in the temple. So there is no priestly footwear. They are always ministering barefoot. And that's kind of the big picture of what they wear. If you're an ordinary priest, you have it much easier. You put on your linen shorts, you put on your tunic, you put on your belt, your sash, and then you have a special hat, a cap or something like that that you wear that's different priest. So that's kind of your, if you can kind of visualize all that, that's what everybody is going to be wearing as they're working at the tabernacle.
You know,
Now the first, go ahead.
well, I was gonna say, maybe you're going here. I might be jumping the gun, but that's what I'm here for. It's just to steal your points.
Hey, jump that gun. Go ahead.
I think it's super fascinating that the priest and the high priest, they have to put on all of these clothes to get ready to do their priestly work, right? But they don't do their priestly work apart from an elaborate coverings. They have to cover themselves up and they go do their work, which is completely the opposite of Christ, the great high priest, who does his work stripped down naked. I don't know if you guys know this, but Jesus wasn't crucified with a discreet loincloth. They just stripped that guy naked and hung him up on the cross. And so while us, we are, when we go to do the work of God, are commanded to put on clothes, and the priests and the high priest of old have to put on many, many like layers of garments. When the great high priest comes to do his work, when it actually comes time for all of this to be fulfilled, the opposite happens, and he's stripped down nude and nailed to a tree, and his blood is cast all over everything. Because ultimately, he's the only one that can really do this work, and he doesn't in bare humanity.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the ironic ways that God works, is that when he brings everything to fulfillment, he does so in a way that is exactly the opposite of what we would expect. So this is the greatest sacrifice, but it's not a lamb, it's not a bull. Instead, it's a human. And it happens in Jerusalem, but it's really outside Jerusalem. It's outside the city gate. And as you point out, this great high priest is not clad in all these various layers and whatnot. Instead, he's stripped down to nothing. So he's stripped down in order that he might then turn around and clothe us with his own righteousness and make us into the priest who are of him, and the kings and the queens who are of him as well. So the first thing that's discussed in this chapter, the first particular part of the high priest vestments, is the ephod. And this is the vest-like article that also has on its center, on the chest part, what's called the breastpiece. Now, this is, I don't know if this, I'm having a hard time deciding which is my favorite part of what the high priest is going to wear, but this has to rank pretty high. It is the very first thing that's discussed. So it's made out of gold, and it's made out of the same stuff that the tabernacle's made out of. Blue, purple, scarlet material. There's gold. There's fine twisted linen. So you can kind of think of the priest as this walking, serving tabernacle. I mean, he's like the a human being who is clothed in a tabernacle. That's one of the ways in which he is pointing forward to Christ. just like Christ is the Word made flesh who tabernacled among us. So you have this high priest walking around, ministering, speaking the words of God, serving at the altar, and he's wearing the same stuff that the tabernacle itself is made out of. It's pretty phenomenal when you consider it that way, that you have the tabernacle, yes, but you also have a high priest who is like almost another tabernacle, a human being who's wrapped in this holy stuff that the tabernacle is made out of, speaking the words of God, representing God to the people, offering sacrifices. So in that capacity, the high priest is also the one who is embodying this prophecy of the Messiah. And one of the things he wears is then this ephod, and this ephod has some stones on it. There's two onyx stones, and on these you have the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. You have six names on one stone and six names on the other stone. And these go on the shoulder straps that hold the ephod in place. And I'm going to jump ahead here because I want to talk about both these at the same time. You also have on the breast piece, you have 12 stones. So on the ephod itself, which is the vest, you've got these two stones, six names on one, six names on the other. But then when you get to the breast piece, you have 12 stones. There's four rows of three stones each, and these stones represent the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. So you really have the tribes of Israel, all 12 of them, represented twice on the same article of clothing. The breast piece, which is a square patch. It goes right on the chest. It's attached to the ephod. And on the shoulder straps of the ephod, you have these two precious stones that have the names of the 12 tribes of Israel engraved into them. Well, what's going on here? Well, just picture this. Every time that the high priest is at the altar, every time the high priest is walking into the holy place and consuming the sacred bread, or trimming the lamps, or standing in front of the altar of incense, offering up prayers for the people. And every time that the high priest walks into the most holy place on Yom Kippur to sprinkle blood toward the mercy seat, he is not just a man. He's not just one individual. He bears on him the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. So that where he goes and what he does, he is the nation reduced down to one person. So when he steps into the presence of God, all of Israel steps into the presence of God with him. Their names are actually on his body. Now, when you think about this in relation to its fulfillment, that's where you see this rich and beautiful Christology. Because what was happening with the vestments of the high priest happens in reality with Christ, because he is humanity reduced down to one person. And he doesn't just have our names on him. Instead, he has our own flesh and blood. And when he steps into the Holy of Holies, into the presence of the Father, when he offers prayers on our behalf, when he presents himself as the sacrifice, then when the Father sees him, he sees all humanity in him. And that's why we can say that when the Father sees us, he sees us in Christ, because he is our great high priest who has our very flesh and blood, the names of who we are in his own body, so that where he is, we are. And when the Father sees him, he sees us in our great high priest.
Amen. And that is it. That's where
all
we
right.
got to end it.
40 minutes is up.
40 minutes is up. That was that's good stuff, though. All right.
Yeah, there's more of it to come.
Yeah. Well, Chad, thanks for hanging out. Everybody, come hang out with me and Chad in San Diego. We would love to see you. But either way, we'll be back next week.
See you then.